everybody. Welcome to the Region 7 Brownfields Proposal Guidelines teleconference. We're here today to answer your questions on the Brownfields Proposal Guidelines before the deadline for submission on October 12th. Just a few logistics. When you want to ask a question, you can do it on the phone or through the online function, and then I'll read them to the Region 7 staff in order to answer them. Either way is fine. If you want to mute your phone, it's *6, and unmute is #6. And EPA will offer a 5-minute warning at the end of the session to make sure that we've gotten all the questions answered during this time. If there's a lot of questions, we'll be open for the full 2 hours. And at this point, I was going to leave it over to Region 7 to introduce themselves.
Okay. Wendy, thank you. I'm Brad Vann. I'm the project officer here with Region 7. And actually, Stephanie Dooling was going to moderate this today, but she might be calling in later. She's out in the field unexpectedly.
Right? I'm here.
Oh, Stephanie's out there. Hi, Stephanie.
Yeah.
And I'll let everybody else go ahead and introduce themselves.
Bob Richards. I'm an attorney helping the Brownfields program.
Deborah Kennedy. I'm a project manager with Cleanup Lead.
Steve Collette. I'm the branch manager for the Brownfields program.
Alma Marino Long. I'm the coordinator for the competition this year.
Jean Schumacher. I'm a project officer with EPA.
Jim Seiler, I'm the RLF lead.
And that's it. You've got the room full. So at this point, I think we'd probably just go ahead and open ourselves up to any kind of questions. Wendy, did you have any online already, or do we just want to open it up to everybody that's on the call?
Let's just open up to everybody on the call. There's no currently written questions. And then I would just ask for those who asked the call to state your name to help us record, you know, the questions and answers.
Okay, first up, who wants to go? Nobody. We do it like wrestling. Going once, going twice. Well, it's going to be a short one. Hello, is somebody else tuning in?
Yeah, you have State of Nebraska, Charlene Sunderman and Cindy Mizbeck.
Hi, Charlene. We've got a handful of folks here on the call so far.
Okay.
And we just opened it up for questions.
Great.
And to see if anybody has any questions at this point. Again, the purpose of this call was exactly that, question and answers. I know a lot of you are out there preparing feverishly your proposals to get them in by October 12th, and a lot of folks may have some last-minute concerns or clarifications. So at this point, we've just opened it up for questions, and again, does anybody out there have a question at this point, or are they just kind of waiting to see if somebody else chimes in with questions?
This is Tom Miller with the Illinois EPA.
Okay, hi Tom.
I'm in the Brownfields program, one of the project managers here in Southern Illinois.
Good to meet you.
Good to meet you. I just got a question about, can you go over a little bit benefits or not benefits of electronic filing versus paper filing? So we've had some questions on that. We've gotten some different kind of answers on, you know, if that's a good thing or a bad thing as far as doing it electronically.
Okay. This is Bob Richards. I'm the attorney. As far as the content of your submittal or our evaluation of it, it doesn't make any difference whether it comes in as paper or electronic. I think what you're really looking for is your convenience and the security of making sure you meet the deadline. Those are the main issues.
Yeah, it wasn't so much the security. I guess some of our Brownfields project managers at US EPA said there was some concerns or some problems with the electronic filing process and that we may want to go paper. That was my main concern.
Well, it has been an issue in our region. We have had an experience where a person attempted to use the system. As far as we can tell, maybe that person wasn't adept or experienced in that system, and it didn't get in on time. And there was really nothing we could do to make it earlier. And so, the government promotes paperless, and that's an EPA, I guess, goal. But my advice as an attorney is, you know, it's only 15 pages or so.
Right. So, would you suggest doing both?
You can do both if you want, but I think that the mail should be, you know, a reasonable method to submit it.
Okay.
You can do both, but
one or the other's fine. Okay, that's fine.
And I'll tell you, Tom, too, the applicants are required to, of course, submit a copy to their home region at the same time.
Correct.
And that's what happened last year. We had an applicant that was deemed ineligible because not only did she have issues, she also waited until the last minute, which made it kind of hard.
Right.
You know, you certainly don't want to do it the last day with any sort of electronic submittal. You're just going to run into problems.
Correct.
And also, this individual did not file a hard copy with our region at that same time. If they had, then headquarters would have said, well, it's fine. We'll go by your post date on your copy.
Okay.
So whichever way works best for most people, if you're comfortable with electronic, you know, I'd say do use electronic system, but still you have to file that hard copy with your home region.
Correct. And I guess one of the other points that was brought up about the electronic is that the electronic form, I think it's, I don't have it in front of me, like the 242 form, it doesn't have, they said, some of the information that's required on the application. So that you're supposed to basically cut and paste the stuff that's not on that form and make sure you include that with it. Does that make sense?
I'm not familiar with that issue.
No, we're not familiar with that either, Tom. We'll have to check on that one. You're saying that, restate that for me for clarity. You're just saying.
Okay, from what we were told by one of our Brownfields project managers in one of the regions, US EPA region, that the electronic filing form for submitting grant applications.
Yeah, the 424, right?
Yeah, does not have all the information that's required under the Brownfield grant form.
That would be post-award submissions. Yeah, that's something probably we would want to take up with our grants office.
Okay.
Maybe why that is.
Okay, but that was one of the main reasons why we want to make sure we're really careful about the electronic filing.
Sure, sure.
But I guess to get around that, we can basically just make sure we include all the information as, you know, as an addendum to that.
The other issue with electronic filing is that for those people who are not familiar with it and wait until the week before to actually file, our understanding is that you have to register and it takes some time to become registered with the system. So people may not have allowed themselves enough time to register with the system so that they could then submit their application.
Right. Yeah, I think that was an issue too. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yeah, as long as they send that hard copy to the home region, you know, at the same date, they'll be covered by the post date.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Good question. Anybody else out there? Try to think of any questions we had coming into the office. We did have one yesterday with regard to, had a question from an applicant with regards to attachments. Again, there are, the specific number of attachments are spelled out in the guidelines, but the specific question was with regards to letters of recommendation. They're not well defined in the guidelines where they fit. Of course, they can be an attachment. I don't think anybody's going to exclude letters of recommendation unless you have 500 of them from the entire community. Those I think would be reasonable. Place as attachments, not in the document, so they don't count as your page count. And then I would just also maybe I would cite them somewhere in a language specifically with regards to C letters of rest, but reference ABC in the back, and that'll direct the reader's attention to those. Another question I had was with regards to whether they could use funding to study a watershed, and I told them that no, they couldn't use Brownfield's funding to study a watershed. If there was assessment or cleanup work related specific to that watershed, those funds could be utilized that way, but not just for the study of the watershed itself, and I recommended that they have their applicant talk with the water program, because they do have grants that are applicable specifically to watershed issues. Anybody else have any questions come through this week?
No.
Nope. Pretty quiet week then.
On those letters of recommendation, that's not that's separate from the letter from the state for support, right?
Yes, correct. Now,
you definitely need that, right?
Separate, right, because the state is a required attachment, and you are correct. And the letters of reference would be if they had something, you know, often congressionals will send in their letters of support.
Sure.
Or local dignitaries or what have you, or nonprofits. So I don't think anybody's going to exclude letters of support.
But that state letter is required.
But the state letter is absolutely required. You are correct.
Okay,
so,
thanks.
That one has to be in there, or else it won't even break threshold.
Right.
So good point. Any other concerns out there? Anybody new come on the line here while we were chatting along? And Bob Coleman, by the way, just joined us from our RCRA, our thanks group. Thanks, Bob. And we've just got a handful of folks. Most of the names that signed on haven't shown on, and I don't see any other new names popped up since we've been on the call here.
And there's been no questions submitted online.
No questions submitted online. Well, this might be a very short call. But that's okay. That's a good sign. That means that at least... Hopefully the guidelines have been well clarified in our outreach events and our previous clue-in session. And I heard another beep. Does that mean they left or they came on? Did somebody new come on the call? No, maybe they just signed off. But I'll tell you what, we're gonna leave the line open here for a few minutes and see if anybody else wants to sign on or has any additional questions. And if we don't, then what time is it right now?
9:15.
Why don't we leave the line open to say 9:30? And if nobody else additional signs on, then we'll call it. What do you think, Wendy?
I think that sounds good.
I know a good joke. Any procedural questions or any uncertainties with regards to the competition or upcoming award schedule? We'd be happy to entertain those questions.
And this is Bob Richards, the attorney. If you have any last-minute questions on site eligibility or applicant eligibility, I can talk to you individually on that. If you would call Alma Moreno Long, and her number, just a minute here, let me look it up, is 913-551-7380, and she can take your call and answer it herself or bring me in on the call so that we can try to clarify whether or not a particular piece of property is eligible for this program, or perhaps sometimes find different ways, a different entity or workaround, so that if it is a particular property of interest in the community, we still may be able to get funding directed to that or get you past the threshold.
Bob, this is Karen Massey. I did have one question on obtaining access to the sites. I think I have my notes from the last time we applied that contractually we could get authorization to access that site. Is that correct, in case of an emergency or default?
Trying to think, is this for an existing grant that you have, or is this for a piece of property that you're submitting an application?
It's an RLF application, so just future sites that we would be funding the cleanup on.
I know that one of the elements in the administration of an RLF is that there still be a means to access or cause the property, I think, to be at least if the project is started and the loan defaults, something like that, that the property will be made safe. And so you have to have some authorities to get onto the property in order to do that. And typically that would be contractual, but also I think that we're looking for enforcement too. You know, under the state authorities, probably more as a nuisance or something like that. Jim Seiler, our RLF expert, is rattling his head. I think he's in agreement. Was that the question you answer or question you were looking for, Karen?
That was it. Thank you.
This is Tom Miller with the Illinois EPA. Do you guys have the actual mailing address to mail the hard copies to the for the grant applications?
Let me see here. Pull the proposals. You got them in front of us, Tom. Hang on just a sec.
Appendix 1 on page 61.
Page 61?
It has the regional brownfields contacts.
Okay.
And all of their addresses.
Okay.
Numbers and email.
Now, those are the regional mail-ins. Were you looking for the...
Yeah, we're looking for the... Where do we mail the actual
application? That goes to the contractor at EMS. Let me find a submission portion, and we can let you know where that goes here. Give us just a sec. We'll feverishly thumb through our copies here. If the page changes every year. On submission. Pages... Oh, 20? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's page 20 of the guideline.
Okay.
And the address is Environmental Management Support, Inc. And that would be attention, Mr. Don West, WEST. Address is 8601 Georgia Avenue, Suite 500. And that is in Silver Spring, Maryland, MD, zip code 20910, and there's a phone number contact on there as well, which is 301-589-5318.
Okay.
Okay. And overnight mail must include Mr. West's phone number, obviously. You know, they always want that phone number.
Okay.
FedEx shipments or whatever.
All right, thanks.
And again, if you get a copy of the guidelines, it's at the top, page 20.
Okay. Yeah, we had it, but I guess the electronic version that we had, we were having problems finding it, so.
Exactly. Understand.
Okay, thanks. Well, it's just important to know where you need to send this thing, because you can't tell us you have it if you don't send it to the right place.
You betcha. Anybody else out there got anything?
This is Cindy. I have a question for you, please.
Okay, Cindy, shoot.
If you have a property that would be coming in under as a site-specific assessment application, and there's, that property does, in fact, have a viable, responsible party, but they have no interest in doing anything with the property or investing anything in it in terms of assessment, so the property is lying fallow. Is that an eligible property if the city or county applies for assessment funding for it?
This is Bob Richards, and I didn't hear the very first few words of your question. Was this a petroleum or a hazardous substance?
Hazardous substances.
Well, actually, possibly both.
Okay, well... Now we won't have time by 9:30 to answer this question. let's tackle hazardous substances first, okay? If it's hazardous substances, that would be things like lead or released out there, or volatile organic compounds, acidic stuff, stuff like that. Anything that's not petroleum. If the city, there is a requirement that the city own the property or that it will obtain ownership by, I believe it's June 30th of next year, 2008, for this
is not cleanup. We're talking about
assessment grant. Assessment grant. You don't have to own the property, okay? If it's hazardous substances, you don't. a owner of the property who is viable, is guilty of sin for the releases on the property, that doesn't matter in the context of hazardous substances. The city does have to have access to the property in order to get on the property in order to do the assessment work.
Okay.
Now, moving on to a petroleum property, it is a different rule on the eligibility of the property, and we have to, there are a number of elements, and I believe it's always skip to question 9, isn't that it? For any petroleum site, or actually it's page 25, and we look to see, it is significant whether or not there is a viable, responsible party, because we look at the current owner and the immediate past owner of the property. And if either of those individuals is responsible for the releases or and financially viable, then that property is not going to be eligible for the grant. If it is somebody who, has no resources but nonetheless is liable, that would be okay. If the viable or responsible party is three owners back in the chain of title, then it would be an eligible property for that assessment work. Are there any, and you do have to have access and agreement to get on to the property in order to do the petroleum assessment work. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, is there a standardized access agreement that should be submitted along with the application?
No. What we are looking for and what is often looked for is just a narrative description that you do have access agreements in place with the property owner. In the alternative, a city can state that they are attempting to negotiate access, and they would have authority to use their sovereign powers, such as eminent domain, in order to obtain access. Although on an assessment work where you're not acquiring the property, that would just be probably another nuisance authority. It'll make it a very weak application if you don't have consensual access and agreement with the party.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? We had a couple of questions come in by email apparently last night via our coordinator, and the submittal was from Chad Howell out of St. Louis Development Corporation. Actually had three questions come in, and they're interesting ones, so I'm going to go ahead and put them out to the group team so we can get them responded, and then we'll get a response back to Chad. His email basically said, "Hi, Susan. With respect to cleanup grants, I can't find much on allowable activities, so I'll just blurt out specifics. If you or one of your cohorts could answer these, it would greatly help planning." So, one, for petroleum cleanup, can grant funds be used to remove underground tanks? This is his first question.
And the answer would be yes. It has to be a qualifying site, not subject, it has to be a low-risk site, all those state determinations and so forth. The tank itself, the removal, if it contains petroleum, is going to be part of that cleanup.
Okay.
What? Yeah. It cannot be part of the underground storage tank program, and, I mean, that is one of the elements in that state determination. But the program is used for these so-called abandoned or orphan sites that don't come under the ambit of the state underground storage tank cleanup funds and such, and the regulatory regime for that.
Okay. Number two, for a hazardous substance cleanup, can grant funds be used to characterize and remove abandoned drums? I think
answer, I think the trick there is the word characterize, because cleanup is not assessment work. But if the term characterize means identify that this is a drum and it should be handled, and the contents of it should be handled in a particular manner, then yes, that's part of the cleanup. And then the removal of the abandoned drum, of course, would be, that's typically how a cleanup occurs. But as part of the cleanup process, it's frequently necessary to take sampling and know what the content of the particular drum is, so you know what landfill to or send it to or how it should be disposed.
Right. Logic would dictate, and maybe I didn't mean to jump in on depth, I think logic would dictate that if a phase two was done, they would have already characterized.
That's what I was going to say. To clarify that a little bit, if there's no information about the contents of that drum, and this is the initial sampling that someone's trying to do under a cleanup grant, that's not really allowed. But if this is to characterize how to properly dispose of this drum, that can be done under a cleanup grant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what if you had some identified drums that show up in the process of
midnight dumping.
Yeah, or something where you dug and suddenly find drums in a fairy that you didn't anticipate.
Then you're identifying what they are for this program.
Part of an ongoing cleanup.
Right. And Alma makes a good point. There's always unknowns, when you, especially if you dig. And maybe those five drums that you thought you had is actually, you know, 50 drums. Then obviously you have to be able to sample those and characterize them for disposal.
It's important to do the just proper presentation rather than just throw it out there when you're doing it. Identify it the way it needs to be identified so it can be cleaned up.
Yeah, and on the disposal side, and we had a question I think a little similar to this come in from one of our active sites with regards to characterizing items for disposal. You might have drums that you've already identified as exceeding some sort of contaminant level, whether say it was a VOC in a drum and you ran it for a VOC analysis, but you didn't characterize it with regards to toxicity for leaching, which is something the recipient landfill may require, such as a TCLP sample or something like this, where they need to know its toxicity levels for proper handling and disposal. So you might know what it is, but they want to know exactly how much this off-spec or disposed of stuff is. So they may require you, the disposal facility may require some additional analysis before receiving your materials, and that can come up. So in that case, you could, we wouldn't say again characterize, we should say identify your materials properly for adequate handling and disposal. And then the third question on this list was, for hazardous cleanup, can grant funds be used to erect a temporary fence to prevent access by unauthorized visitors due care for direct contact issues? And yeah, Bob's giving me the thumbs up, and I think we've tripped over this one before. Absolutely. That's part of your due diligence and due care of your site, and that's also part, usually often that's part of a health and safety component of the site itself, too. To restrict access to any of these properties. So the short answer is yes, you can use your cleanup funds to minimize or prevent access from trespassers.
Well,
that was all the three I had by email.
Yeah, and those are actually more toward actually having a grant in hand and how to spend the money.
Right.
Is there anything else that people have related to the proposal?
Did you have anything?
Okay, Wendy, did you have any emails come out your direction by any chance?
We did not.
Okay. Well, that just means we're doing our job this year, maybe.
Exactly.
Matter, they're just so tired of hearing about it, they don't want to hear any more. But this time, then, I'm going to propose, if we don't have any more questions, we're going to go ahead and wrap this call up. I wanted to thank everybody for their time to call in and
comment? Did you have something to say?
Yeah, I just had a reminder for everyone. Make sure you get your acknowledgement letters from the state. Request those early. If you haven't done so, please do that right away. And then also remember that they can help you in doing your proposal. So please take advantage of that, as well as our CAB program. They can also provide you assistance.
Good point. And Alma makes an excellent point. And remember, Alma is your competition lead for this year. So if you all get into a crunch here down the road and you have a question, she's our point of contact for this year to ask questions or email to. And, again, we thank everybody for their time. Wendy, any parting thoughts?
No, just wanted to thank everybody. And I guess, as you said, to let them, you know, if they have any remaining questions, to get in touch with your office.
Okay. I already got contact. Well, thanks again, everybody. Thank you, Wendy, for putting us together. And thank Amy and Nicole for it.
Definitely.
And everyone have a good day, and good luck on your competition.
Thanks.
Thank you.